The debt crisis continues to rattle Europe and the world.
But there are hopes that maybe, the powers that be can get a handle on it.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. Today is Monday, November 28th.
Well, coming up, a crucial week for leaders to come up with a plan to save the Eurozone.
Yeah, as the borrowing costs rise, Steve, so does the urgency for Europe to fix its debt problems.
Later, who's eating chicken salad at 9 o'clock in the morning?
Apparently more people than you think. And what are some of the biggest etiquette breaches at the office?
You're going to find out ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Carbonite Business, providing automatic online backup solutions for small businesses and the computer files they depend on. Learn more and receive a free trial at Carbonite.com with code Marketplace.
Today, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, we know it as the OECD, published a bunch of pretty grim economic forecasts for the Eurozone. It says economies will shrink, continue to shrink in the next year, and the OECD is calling for decisive action to tackle the continent's big debt crisis. The BBC's Andrew Walker's with us from London with the latest on that story. Hey, Andrew.
Hello there.
So what are some of the plans that we're hearing about in solving or trying to solve this crisis?
Two key things. I think we may well get some more detail on exactly how Europe intends to go about increasing the firepower of its agency for providing financial assistance to struggling European governments. And I think there's also a lot of talk going on, especially between France and Germany, about increased discipline on the finances of governments that use the euro.
I mean, is there anything sort of coming down the pike immediately?
There might well be something on that question of increased discipline. France and Germany would like to get on with this quite quickly, because if there is something in the pipeline that will produce results fairly quickly, then it might just increase the chances of the European Central Bank acting more aggressively to deal with the crisis right now. France in particular would desperately like the bank to do that.
The BBC's Andrew Walker in London. Andrew, thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, one of the ideas that's been talked about to solve the European debt crisis, especially this morning, they're talking about it, is the idea of a fiscal union, Steve.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Basically, you would have the ability by a central government to tell member countries in Europe to cut their budgets. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Fiscal union could be drastic. In its extreme form, it means turning the 17 countries that use the euro into a kind of United States of Europe. A federal European authority would raise taxes and spend the money throughout the eurozone. That would help smooth the differences between weaker countries like Greece and stronger ones like Germany. But James Goundry of IHS Global Insight says absolute fiscal union would only work if Europe was more like America, with one overall identity across the 17 euro member states.
The citizens of these countries are not happy to be spending money on other citizens from different member states. If there was one European identity, I think it'd be much easier to have absolute fiscal union.
He says the reality is that Germans regard themselves as German first and European second, and the same goes for other member countries. He believes a very much weaker form of fiscal union is under discussion. But because it is much weaker, it may not be enough to reassure investors. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Well, at the White House today, President Obama will host some top European Union officials. He's expected to put pressure on them to come up with a solution to the debt crisis to calm the markets. But what exactly is at stake for the United States? For answers, we turn to Marketplace's New York Bureau Chief, Heidi Moore, who joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Heidi, what is the biggest worry for the U.S. right now when it comes to economic fallout from Europe?
Well, of course, the biggest worry is going to be banks. We have been worried about banks forever, and we would be again if there was a European crisis, because they help fund Europe. Another problem, though, and one closer to home, is money market funds. Those are mutual funds that avoid risky investments.
These are funds that are supposed to be super safe. A lot of people have money in them, and they're supposed to be accounts that you can't lose money in, right?
Exactly. They're supposed to be just like cash. They invest in the highest rated securities, which used to be government bonds. But now government bonds all over the world aren't so secure. So the collapse of Lehman Brothers caused a panic, and some money market funds broke the buck. They needed government lifelines to survive. And so investors are more easily spooked now. I talked to Otis Casey at Market, a research firm, and he said that money market funds don't have prenups. They're worried that Europe doesn't have a prenup, rather. Here's what he said about it.
U.S. money market funds have traditionally been a large source of funding to European banks. Because of the sovereign debt problems, U.S. money market funds have been more and more reluctant to increase their exposure.
So what that tells us, of course, is that money market funds are afraid of Europe. The good part is, though, that banks and U.S. companies are far better funded than they were in 2008.
Marketplace's New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore. Heidi, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, one country that at least recently has been at the heart of the Eurozone crisis is Italy. The country held a bond auction today and ended up paying more than 7% interest to borrow money. That, of course, is the point at which a lot of investors say, I don't know if you're going to be able to pay that money back. And it's up from just 4.5% a month ago.
So it's rising very quickly.
It's amazing.
The Italian government today, Steve, decided, you know what? Here's an idea. Let's appeal to patriotism. Today has been designated Bond Day, and ordinary Italians are being urged to dig deep and invest in their government's bonds. From Rome, here's the BBC's Alan Johnston.
The idea for a bond day came after a banker from Tuscany named Giuliano Milani took out a full-page newspaper ad. In it, he issued a personal appeal asking patriotic Italians to buy bonds to help pay for the national debt. Think Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1941.
I ask you to demonstrate again your faith in America by joining me in investing in the new defense savings bonds and stamps. And I know that you will help.
The new initiative here is backed by major Italian banks and the Milan Stock Exchange. They've agreed to waive trading fees on bond purchases made by Italians today. Ordinary Italians, however, may be reluctant to dig into their own pockets amid cuts to the budget and social programs. But one potential buyer here, Marco Massoni, says it's not time to panic. Here he is speaking at an Italian market today.
La crisi è evidente.
The crisis is quite obvious in Italy and internationally. But Italy is a country with enough resources to make it through. We would need a little more courage.
Even so, raising enough money to tackle the towering debt is a huge problem for Italy, even if Italian citizens do, in large numbers, pitch in to try to help bail out the country. In Rome, I'm the BBC's Alan Johnston for Marketplace.
Well, if the patriotism thing, Jeremy, doesn't work out for the folks in Italy, there's another plan European leaders have talked about to contain the crisis, something called ring-fencing. You ever heard that term? Like quarantining those countries with the worst debt problems, keep them safe from other countries so it doesn't spread. Marketplace senior producer Patty Hirsch and I traveled to one place where ring-fencing is commonplace.
Oh, man, we're at the zoo. I love the zoo, Patty. And that's a red-handed tamarin.
Yes, it is, Steve. Now, don't try and pet it, please. There's a fence around it for a reason.
Ah, I get it. A ring fence. You're telling me that European nations are like a bunch of wild animals?
No, I'm saying that in a zoo, some animals have to be kept in their own enclosures. And in Europe right now, some countries need to be kept separate from the rest of the pack. And the idea is to do that with a ring fence.
To stop their problems from getting out and hurting the rest of us, right?
Right, but also so they can get the specific care that they need. I mean, it's like you don't put a tiger in with a gazelles, do you?
No, you do not.
And not just because they might harm each other. A tiger's needs are different to a gazelle's.
And Italy's needs are different to France's.
Exactly. So a ring fence around Italy is going to do two things. It's going to stop its problems infecting anyone else, and it's going to give the Italian government the space it needs to mend the country.
Okay, I get the concept, but how would it work in practice?
All right, let's get one thing straight first. You know, Italy is solvent right now. It is still making money. It does not need a bailout, at least not yet. But if its borrowing costs keep rising, it could go bust.
But how can it bring those borrowing costs down?
Okay, so the borrowing costs are rising because nobody wants to buy Italy's bonds because they're worried it could go bust. And that means that Italy has to pay more and more in interest to buy new bonds. But if someone stepped in, say maybe the European Central Bank, and said, we'll guarantee all of Italy's bonds, then people would be happy to buy them and the cost of borrowing would fall and Italy would be fine again.
All right, so that's the fence going up. How long would that bond guarantee have to stay in place?
Long enough for Italy to make real changes in the way the country runs. All right, the country has to cut its government spending big time. It also has to put reforms in place that are going to allow its companies to become more competitive and productive, and only then will its growth rate rise. And once those reforms kick in and investors believe that Italy can handle its debt, they'll stop treating it like some kind of, I don't know, dangerous animal that's escaped from the zoo.
All right, I get that. But let me ask you this. What zoo animal is Italy?
Well, people say Italy is a kind of a hybrid of Germany and Greece, right? With the industrial north and the sunny south.
Right.
So if Germany's a bear, you know, they like bears up there.
Yeah.
And Greece was, say, a sloth.
A sloth? Patty! Hey, I'm Greek, man.
Well, yeah, I'm sorry, mate. Anyway, somewhere in between those two extremes. So, I don't know, maybe a baboon, you know, flashing its red bottom at everybody, you know.
Marketplace's Patty Hurst. Patty, thanks.
It's a pleasure, Steve.
And many thanks to our field engineer, Brendan Willard, and web producer, Mary Dew, for helping us put that explainer together. We have a slideshow, by the way, of our chat, some ugly pictures of Patty Hirsch and me, complete with animals, too, at marketplace.org.
Well, good news, bad news on the housing market today, Steve. Sales of new homes jumped 1.3% last month, but the median price of a home hit a low for the year.
The National Retail Federation says sales over the last 4 days jumped 16% from last year. Consumers spent an average of $398 on Black Friday. And, of course, Black Thursday and Black Saturday and Black Sunday, too.
All of them.
And about 40% of that shopping was done online.
And we're going to have more about that coming up in our Midday Extra segment, Steve, in just a few minutes.
How Cyber Monday is factoring into the holiday shopping equation, and of course how people are using those cell phones and how they're being used to gauge what people are doing.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Carbonite Business. Carbonite Business is an online automatic backup solution designed specifically for small businesses. Carbonite Business automatically and continually backs up computer files to a secure offsite location. In the event of a hard drive crash, virus, or other computer problem, files can easily be recovered. To learn more about Carbonite Business and to receive a free trial, visit carbonite.com and use the code Marketplace.
And now to the Marketplace global perspective. Egyptians began voting today in the first phase of parliamentary elections. The country's been in economic turmoil since Hosni Mubarak was booted from office earlier this year. But in some parts of Cairo, reporter Julia Simon says it's business as usual.
In the area of Shubra in northern Cairo, a boulevard lined with factories has continued to spurt smoke all throughout the Arab Spring. Despite the violence just a half an hour away in Tahrir Square, tens of thousands of Egyptians show up here every day for work, as they have been all this year.
Everything in Egypt is going on the same before, no any change.
Haisama Saeed is the production manager of a clothing factory in Shubra. The factory makes inexpensive clothes that sell in stores in the U.S. Egypt's GDP is about the size of Louisiana's, and while the country's economy has slowed to a 1% growth rate since Mubarak's ouster, the unrest downtown against the army doesn't mean people aren't going to work. Al-Sayed says it's important to remember Tahrir isn't Egypt.
Maybe I'm not happy for all action happened in Tahrir Square because I don't like foreigner people to hear that we have a problem in Egypt.
The latest instability closed the Egyptian stock market recently, but it hasn't scared off all investors. Just last week, General Motors announced that it plans to open a car assembly factory in Egypt starting in 2012. And because he exports to America, Al-Sayed says he's just as worried about the U.S. economy as he is about Egypt's. In Cairo, I'm Julia Simon for Marketplace.
The annual UN Climate Summit starts today in Durban, South Africa. Steve, you remember last year's Cancun Summit, the one that produced a groundbreaking deal that's being implemented? That didn't happen. Maybe it was the year before in Copenhagen when they came up with a landmark agreement
No,
these summits don't really have a very good track record. Well, joining us now to discuss what we might expect or not expect out of Durban is Marketplace Sustainability Desk reporter Eve Troe. Good morning.
Good morning.
So why do they keep holding these conferences if it doesn't seem like anything big ever happens at them?
Well, nothing big seems to happen, but little pieces of the puzzle do get figured out, and that's enough to keep people going. Mm. Last year in Mexico, we ended with a standing ovation, which I think was unprecedented. And we came out with something called the Cancun Agreements. That made progress on a few things: deforestation, getting funding and technology to poorer countries so they can fight climate change faster. But we also saw the Kyoto Protocol brought to the brink of death.
Yeah.
And all these countries that have signed on to legally binding emissions reductions targets said, hey, the U.S. and China, the biggest polluters in the world, are not even part of this. Why should we keep going?
And nothing really has changed on that front, right? The U.S. and China are not ready to sign on to the Kyoto Protocol.
No, definitely not. And the future of the Kyoto Protocol is really the big issue we'll see these next 2 weeks. It expires next year if the countries who are on it don't sign on for a second commitment period.
So what are we expecting out of the Durban conference?
Lots of people speculating on this. I talked to David Wasko. He's in charge of climate change for Oxfam America. He says there is a danger we could come out of these 2 weeks with agreements that add up to less than what we already have on the books.
If the U.S. puts down a really rigid red line in terms of what they want a country like China or India or Brazil, for example, to do, rather than finding ways to keep the ball rolling, we could see backsliding instead.
So backsliding would mean countries back out of Kyoto. They set voluntary targets for emissions, which I heard one expert describe as letting kids decide how much homework they want to do. Not very likely to get the job
Probably
done.
Probably not going to work. Marketplace's Eve Tro from our sustainability desk. Eve, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, back here in this country now, Fairfax County, Virginia, which is a suburb of Washington, D.C., Northern Virginia, seems to be on an economic roll. Over the past few months, six major corporations have moved their headquarters there, and the unemployment rate is at a super low 4.6%, if you can believe it. The national unemployment rate, of course, sits at 9%. So what explains the Fairfax County economic success? Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
The president of the Fairfax County Economic Development Authority, Gerald Gordon, knows how to joke about the huge federal sugar daddy right across the Potomac River.
The smartest economic development strategy we ever employed was locating next to the federal government. Brilliant.
The Development Authority has helped lure some prominent companies that aren't government contractors, like Hilton Hotels and Volkswagen of America. Stephen Fuller with the Center for Regional Analysis says those companies are attracted to powerful connections on a global scale.
There are 186 foreign embassies here. It's a good place to connect.
But Gordon recognizes the government's largesse isn't permanent.
If overall federal procurement declines, then other industries within Fairfax County prop up the economy and sustain it.
He says the new companies like Fairfax County because of its attractive tax incentives and skilled workers. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Well, I don't know about you, Steve, but I have been having a lot of turkey over the last few days and stuffing and mashed potatoes and Brussels sprouts and the whole lot of it.
Yeah.
And literally breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Yeah.
Well, if you think that's weird at 9 a.m. to be eating turkey and stuffing, it is not. According to some of the nation's biggest food chains, Dunkin' Donuts says it sells tons of chicken salad sandwiches at breakfast time.
At breakfast?
McDonald's says 20% of cookies and apple pies are sold in the early morning hours.
I've had some of their cookies at
and
breakfast.
And Kellogg says, and this one does not surprise me that much, that about a third of all cereal is eaten for meals other than breakfast.
You've seen my cabinet in my office, haven't you,
Jeremy? That's true. Lucky Charms, Fruit Loops.
There are more cereal boxes than there are books.
Yeah, that's right.
Shelves. It's just funny. But yeah, you can eat that stuff anyhow, especially when you're working in the middle of the night. You have to eat whatever you need to eat, right?
Fruit Loops,
whatever.
Fruity
Sometimes
Pebbles.
I'll go healthy. I'll do
Cocoa
a special
Pebbles.
K occasionally.
Yeah, right. I've never seen that.
Later this week, the patent will expire for blockbuster cholesterol-reducing drug Lipitor. It is the best-selling drug in history. And as Marketplace's Gregory Warner reports from the health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, its parent firm, Pfizer, is trying out a new strategy to hang on to those sales.
Drug companies usually squeeze every last sale that they can out of a drug until it goes off patent. And then the generic manufacturers will gradually take over the business.
Most brand name companies, when they lost their patent protection, would essentially walk away from the brand.
Mike McCann writes the online trade publication RPM Report. He says Pfizer can't afford to walk away from the best-selling drug of all time, so the company has partnered with a pharmacy in Michigan to sell Lipitor by mail order at generic prices.
They're going to make it as easy as possible for you to buy brand name Pfizer and not pay any more than you would for a generic drug.
Pfizer is banking on consumers willing to buy drugs online and a lot of Lipitor loyalty. If the strategy works, other drug companies will follow. There are a lot of blockbusters with patents expiring. Next up this spring is Plavix, the country's third best-selling drug. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Well, it's Cyber Monday, Steve, and it seems like this year's holiday shopping is a whole lot more cyber than even it was last year.
Indeed.
And maybe even more mobile. Last week, we had a story on the show about how you should be taking your cell phones with you shopping so that you can comparison shop
and
look things up. And then on my drive home, I hear somebody else say, don't take your cell phones with you because they can be used to track you in the malls during the holidays.
Yeah, but they're just gauging foot traffic.
Well, whatever.
Right?
I mean, but anyway, that's what I heard. Two sides of the same coin.
In today's Midday Extra, we're going to ask, are smartphones a blessing or are they a curse for holiday shopping? And Sucharita Mulparu is an analyst at Forrester Research, and she's with us now. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. What do businesses, Sucharita, have to gain from shoppers using cell phones?
Well, businesses that have great prices have a lot to gain because they're the ones that will win in this environment where consumers have the ability to visit various apps and comparison price check, particularly for commodity products that are easily comparable, like electronics or sporting goods. It's less of an issue for products like apparel or footwear, but for those companies, especially those pure plays, companies like Amazon or even eBay that often do win on price, they're the ones that really win, and that really puts a lot of physical stores, a lot of the big box traditional retailers that we know, in a pinch because people very easily know whether or not they have the best price.
Well, then what about consumers? Are they getting a good deal by bringing their cell phone in, or are they just being used like pawns and, just being tracked and all that?
Well, I think that both are true, and I think that the reality is that it's a little bit of a trade-off on both sides, because typically the savings that you can often get by shopping online are pretty significant. There are quite a few studies that have actually been done on the level of how much of a price premium that companies like Amazon actually are able to have for customers, and, well, I should say, you know, how much of a discount they often have for a lot of easily comparable baskets of products, be it toys or consumer electronics products, and that figure is not insubstantial. I mean, it can be higher than 10% of a discount. So for a product that you may be spending several hundred dollars on, it absolutely is a benefit to be able to get, say, a 10% discount on that by simply knowing what is the best retailer to actually make that purchase with. Now, on the flip side, there is this emerging concern of companies that are able to put transponders out in malls and track your every step and see which stores you walked in front of and whatnot. Right now, it's a fairly innocuous approach. It's really just to gather data to help a mall operator basically charge a premium for some of the tenants that end up being in the mall. But that remains to be seen whether or not some of the use cases for that information will end up being invasive or more about marketing. But for now, it's usually the benefit of saving money outweighs anybody tracking you.
This is nothing new, though, right, Sucharita, that privacy concerns and things like that, because people are tracked everywhere. You can't take a picture with your iPhone without having someone know where that picture was taken. So I don't know if people are not bothered by that. Why would they be bothered in the shopping mall, whether they went to Tom McCann or
Yankee Candle.
Candle,
right.
Or the great
sure
chocolate chip cookie
Tom
company.
Tom McCann's still around. But
that shows you how old I am, Sucharita.
That's a fair point. And, especially in this era of Facebook and Foursquare, where people are already publicizing and volunteering so much about their own lives, what's to really say that it's that much more invasive for some third party to be, passively gathering this information that really doesn't get shared with anyone else. So certainly we're in a new era where people are less concerned about privacy, but, so long as nobody does something foolish and, violates, the conventions of what is acceptable, I suspect that, we'll have this era where our cell phones are just going to be tracked, and that's just the way it is.
Let me ask you two quick things, Sucharita. First of all, if that was Black Friday last Friday, today's Cyber Monday, is there a mobile day? Do we know? Is it like Mobile Tuesday or something like
no,
that?
No, it's got to be an M. So Mobile Monday, no.
That's a great marketing idea. And since Cyber Monday started as essentially a machination of a bunch of marketers, you know, I think that's a great idea to have like a mobile marketing, you know, week.
You heard it here first. Yeah, you can send the checks my way. Yeah. But let me ask you this other question, which is, do you think that it's possible that the people who are going out and shopping for these deals would be buying things anyway later on, and that actually a strong Black Friday or a strong Cyber Monday hurts sales that would happen over the next month?
That is such a smart and astute point, and that is absolutely true. That's exactly what's happening. And there are a few studies that have actually been done that whenever you do have a big promotional day or set of days, this applies to days like Black Friday and Cyber Monday, this applies to sales tax holidays, that when you do offer those days, you're shifting behavior. And usually from our estimates and what we see from consumers, usually about 70% of what is spent on those days, that's incremental, that's spent on those days, you know, the lift that you see is usually just people shifting their behavior toward a week versus shopping later for a purchase they would have done anyway.
It's either that or they're going to buy more for mom and dad or for their children or whatever. And and in this economy, I would be willing to bet that it's not more. It's probably as much or less.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
Exactly. And it's a great day. Yeah. And you do end up having these great offers. Now, some percent, usually about, you know, 25-30% actually are people buying for themselves, and these are things that they're inspired to buy just because of the holiday weekend and because of the great sales. But, you know, that's a minority, and, you know, kind of really it ends up probably being a wash, or to your point, you know, just basically cannibalizing sales that would have happened in you know, later in December. So that is the big question, is wow. that, you know, so are we just shifting the demand to November, and, you know, we're planning on seeing a softer December as a result of it, or are retailers going to have to pull out more stops and more discounts in order to, you know, kind of make up for or to, you know, in order to continue to comp what they need to do.
Sucharita Mulparu is an analyst with Forrester Research. Thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much. And finally, this morning, Jeremy, it's not easy these days finding coworkers who are respectful at the office. I'm not going to say anything about you right now I'm trying to be
That's
respectful.
Not fair.
Right, I know. The California staffing company Robert Half International's latest survey of hundreds of U.S. office workers from across the country lists some of the most egregious breaches of etiquette at work, such as throwing papers in a furious fit over a work project. Have you ever seen anything like that here at Marketplace?
Let me say.
Oh.
Yeah.
It didn't
there
make,
you go.
It didn't
yeah,
make
you
the effect
made a mess
that I wanted
the studio.
Kai Rizdahl's not going to like me for this. taking a picture of a coworker sleeping on the job and then sending it to the boss.
Ooh, that's rough.
That's mean.
That's just mean.
And the etiquette breach I have the biggest beef with, and I think probably other people do as well, is stealing someone's lunch out of the company fridge. I mean, come on.
All right. But Steve, let
have
me just
say.
Have
you done that before? You've
no,
never stolen
I have not stolen.
Food.
I would never steal anybody's food out of the company fridge. But what I will say is people need to take their own food out of the fridge because it just piles up. It's like, why are you
We have a list on our door, right? The refrigerator. Is it time to clean out the refrigerator?
Yeah, they never do.
No, they never really follow through.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Steve Chiotakis. This is the Marketplace Midday Update. Enjoy your Monday.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.